I do dream about walking in the door, the reverse of when I left and everyone was so upset. Instead, she's making potato pancakes in the kitchen, and Dad is smoking on the fire escape, Curly doing her homework by the radio, and Jack reading his comics, and not a Marine, and Ted probably fixing something Jack broke. And Ma looks up and sees me, and I can just imagine the smile on her face. What I wouldn't give just to see her for a little while. I miss her and everything awfully. Imagine if time machines were real and I could go back. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Fuck you!
Having fun in here, Sarge?
Don't fucking call me that.
What's that? My hearing ain't so good these days.
Were you asleep?
Sarge, I'm 90 fucking 4 years old. All I do is sleep. Except at night. I'm just down the hall, alright?
Yeah. It is strange to think of those days in Sicily when all of us were sure we would be home for Christmas. And of course, when Trowina was the worst thing I ever saw in my life. I should stop thinking anything is the worst I've ever seen, as God seems to take it as a challenge. At any rate, it looks like we will be spending Christmas here at the country house. But it does have a cook, and I guess the folk station here are putting on a Christmas program with singing and dancing. It will not be too bad. What I want, of course, is all of us crammed around our table on Christmas Eve, with Ma's bread and a turkey, and Mamalika and wine and all of it, and Curly bouncing in her seat so excited to go to Christmas Mass, and then for it to be Christmas tomorrow, and for Dad to toss me an orange he wrapped in paper and tell me to guess, and for me to say, "Is it a baseball pop?" like I did every year. Is it a baseball? Is it a baseball? Is it a baseball pop? It's a fucking orange. It's December 22nd. I met Howard Stark today. Me, Bucky Barnes of Brooklyn. I think Steve will never let me forget it, because I have never been tongue-tied in my life. And there I was, like a blushing dame in a dance hall, too embarrassed to say a word, even with Steve, about in tears he was laughing so hard. Hell, I don't know what happened. But anyway, Steve met Mr. Stark back in Brooklyn during the big old show. And for that alone, I ought to punch Mr. Stark straight in the mouth. But then, he introduced me to this gun. I guess as soon as Mr. Stark heard Steve had found himself a sharpshooter, as if that was new, I could hit a bottle from 50 yards with my slingshot as a kid, and Steve knows it, even if he couldn't see the bottle at 10 yards, let alone 50 back then, he started going through his own armory. Now, Mr. Stark doesn't do a lot of work with small arms, but I guess he's real friendly with the fella who designed this rifle, the M1941 Johnson, and so he got a hold of one of the factory set-asides, the show rifles who've been fired, hell, probably 25,000 times apiece, and are the most accurate of the rest. Then he took her apart and built her back up and fixed her up with this scope like nothing I have ever seen before, and she is called Betsy. We took her out on the range with Fallsworth and a few of his buddies, and Mr. Stark, of course. I have been using an M1C like I used to have, and I thought it was pretty good, but I have never heard a quieter gun than Betsy in all my life. Mr. Stark says he modified the carbine and the barrel to reduce the noise, and he did something also to do with muzzle flash. She's a beauty. Anyhow, I showed the Tommy bastards how it's done, and got a couple of free beers for my troubles, seeing as how none of them know how to back down from a bet. Even if they are warm, they are better than paying for warm beer. Later. Aside from that day in Asano, I have finally found a reason to like Captain America, other than the broads who blush at him when he walks into the pub and then settle for his pal when they figure out he don't have eyes for anybody but his best girl. So Steve apparently heard in a letter from my ma, and Jesus, thanks ma, that Teddy is here in England, in Aldbourne, shipped out with a 506 PIR months ago when I was in Italy. Anyhow, Steve wrangled it with the brass that yes, yes, training was important, but everybody deserved a 2-day pass for Christmas, and also permission to go to Aldbourne as there is a training airfield around there, and we are all supposed to be getting our jump wings. Well, Falsworth did some work on his end, and apparently so did Agent Carter, and it is all worked out. We are free for 2 days, and then stay in Aldbourne for at least 4 days after. I will have 6 days with Teddy, assuming he can get away from his unit. It is not Christmas yet, but no doubt this is the best Christmas present I will ever receive. For the first time since coming to England, it seems like something will be all right finally. December 24th. Train from London to Aldbourne this morning. Teddy there waiting with a few of his platoon with an army truck at the station. It is hard to explain what it is like to see your kid brother when you last thought you would never see him again at all. It took about all I had not to lose it completely, but I hugged him for about an hour, and then so did Steve, who has not seen him since last Christmas either as Teddy was in training. Teddy's eyes about popped out of his head like he was a real-life Looney Tune when he saw Steve. I thought I was seeing things, I told Ted while Steve got red. That's it, I'm done for. I am imagining Steve running around looking like some kind of Max Schmeling type dressed up in a flag. I must be on my way out. It's a hell of a sight, says Teddy, sounding just as gobsmacked as he looked, and peered closer. Steve, I haven't looked up at you since I was 12. And Steve rolls his eyes. 13, thank you, Teddy. And just like that, it's all normal again, even if Steve is taller than me now. Anyhow, we introduce everyone. Jones, Morta, and Dugan are with us. Falsworth staying in London to spend Christmas with his family, and Dernier presumably with several bottles of wine and as many dames as he can find. In the truck, which is driven by a friend of Teddy's who is certainly not supposed to be driving it, they are all airborne, which, based on what I have heard about the 82nd, means they no doubt think they are real hotshots. Anyhow, his friends are PFC McNamara and Corporal Bergen, and they seem like decent fellows, at least judging by the fact that McNamara drove us all straight to the pub instead of the base. Of course, pub was full of mostly other men from the regiment, and as soon as they figured out who Steve was, they wanted the story about his honor. But seeing as how we've been told to zip up about that, he had to give the abridged version. Drank for hours and tossed out about 6 pints for my men. And then some fella started tickling the keys in the corner, and we got ourselves a little dance going, with about 8 whole dames who live in this town, and half of those old enough to be our own mothers. But who the hell cares? It's Christmas. December 25th. So late it may not be Christmas anymore, but I still can't seem to sleep for more than a few hours at a time, and I took off my watch so I don't know if it's still Christmas. There is one thing that C and Teddy has reminded me of. It is that there never was a sweeter or kinder boy than him. And so what in God's name is he doing as a paratrooper? I cannot account for someone like him being put into war at all. He doesn't deserve it. I think all I can hope for is somehow Steve and me and this strange collection of commandos to find a way to end things before it becomes Teddy's job to take on as well. I can't stop thinking of Teddy facing Italy or another Vanafro. I am also thinking very much about Margaret. By now she would have had the babies. Harry felt so rotten about her going it alone with him here. And now it won't just be for the war. Not just for a first Christmas with their babies, but forever. I cannot think of it without feeling almost hopeless. I don't understand how God could stop a guy like Harry from making it home. I did write my letter to her and send it, but I don't know if it was the right thing. If I was her, I can't imagine wanting to hear from your husband's best friend who didn't keep him alive. What good am I if I can't even do that? Anyhow, this is the first Christmas in my life I spent away from home. I remember in 42 it was a close shave because of training, but I made it. Teddy here is homesick too, but not quite as desperately as me. I suppose it is because he and the rest of his pals are excited to just get on with the job. They haven't been in combat. Teddy has told them enough from my letters that they knew where I have been and wanted the details.
You ever shot a kraut?
Like they were asking. You ever hit a homer? Fortunately, Dugan was there, as he is a better storyteller than I am these days. Christmas 43 is done. It feels empty wishing this, but maybe God will have some mercy on everyone at last, and it will be Christmas in Brooklyn next year.
December 26th.
Technically, everyone is back on duty today, but Teddy's command is being generous, seeing as half the regiment is hungover and the other half still drunk. Teddy swung by the house where we are billeted, and the couple who owns the house made us both tea. The Wraithwhistles, Reginald and Clementine. Where do the Brits get these names? And then we stepped out for a smoke or five. Not with his pals around, Teddy suddenly looked a lot more like my real kid brother. He always was so serious. Though anyone would be compared to Jack, wouldn't he? And then, just like that, he was 11 and me 15, and coming to me worried and almost in tears about Dad losing his job and should he quit school too? This is what Teddy will always be in my eyes. No matter that he has his jump wings and he's a man of 22, and no doubt soon will be in combat. He is forever my kind-hearted brother whose first thought is always for others. Anyhow, it was plain that something was on his mind, and that is another thing about Ted. It may be difficult to say or do, but once his mind is set, he will do it. That is why I did not argue with him about enlisting. No one can make Teddy do anything but himself. Of course, Jack is not quite like that. More often than not, he will do the opposite of what you tell him just to spite you. Lovely, funny Jack. He asked me after a moment, "What happened out there?" I tried shrugging it off. "You heard the story, pal." And all Ted had to do was give me a look, and suddenly it is like I cannot speak at all. "I know the 107th was shredded," he says in his quiet way. "Even if it doesn't say as much in the papers, we read that of the 400 or so that got rescued, only about 200 were GIs, and them all from different units. What happened?" I told him the basic story. That the regiment had ordered 1st and 2nd Battalion to assault Venafro in support of the 30th Infantry. That there were more krauts by far than any of the intel said. That Abel's role was to support Charlie and Baker after the main thrust. That by the time we arrived it was a fucking slaughterhouse. I tried to tell him, but I could not really get all the words out about how we fought for 18 hours straight until word came down the line that Lieutenant Kurlansky had called for Abel's surrender, as the only officer left alive anybody knew of. That when the Kraut commander came to take the surrender, he accepted it, and then drew a Luger and shot Kurlansky in the head. I remember watching it, and not feeling anything at all, so blank from all that had happened, and Harry. I suppose it was combat fatigue. What I said was, "Nearly all my friends are dead." And that is true. Otis Sheehan and I spent practically the entire march trying to get together what we could of Abel, and were only able to find less than 24 of our entire company alive, and most of them banged up to hell. Of what happened in the camp, I could not tell Ted that. I don't even want to remember it. I keep praying I will stop remembering it. Teddy doesn't say anything for a long while, just lights another smoke for me as we walk around the village. I can imagine Harry raising an eyebrow and saying, "Well, this is quaint." It is in the middle of the country with cows and sheep and little gardens. It is so peaceful that it feels like it cannot possibly be real. "How did you get through it all?" Tad asks me finally. I thought he meant about being a POW, but he said no, he meant about combat. Was I scared? And he is looking at me, his calm face as open as ever. He always was the most solemn of us all. I find for the first time in his life I am not sure how to answer his question. Better to try and prepare him somehow, knowing that nothing can prepare you for combat? Or is it better to lie and say that it is not as scary once you are in it? And I thought of Harry, and then just said, "Be the kind of man you'd want next to you in a foxhole." Because at the end of it all, though we are fighting Germany and Hitler, etc., etc., when you are in combat, that is the last thing on your mind. You are not fighting for God and country. You are fighting for your friends and just trying not to let them down. A man in these circumstances will do just about anything he can not to let his friends down. Anyhow, Teddy has never let anyone down in all his life. He will not start now. And I told him that, too. And then it was time to meet Steve and the rest back at the airfield. December 28th. Only 2 days at Holborn to get our wings. Called back to London for briefing, and we expect a mission. We have only been a unit for 4 weeks, but I suppose the brass thing sets enough. Meanwhile, Frog Lord are still arguing about the better hand signals to use. There is an anxiousness in my chest about all this, but at the same time I feel resolute. I am resigned to this decision and would make it again and again, but that does not stop a man from thinking about the combat ahead. Steve says the telegram did not say much, only where to return and when. There was another group of GIs boarding the train at a different stop. I do not know which stop. Apparently the British don't have station signs. And they came into our car and got very angry that Jones was here. Well, that's one way to get on Steve's bad side for sure. We were all seated, and this fellow with the same accent as Powell, God rest his soul, got the idea to start a fight. Easy then not to mistake him for Powell, who could never say an unkind word in his life. Hell, he did not even curse. I always been as happy as a gopher in soft dirt, Sarge. What do I got to cuss for? Well, for the first time in his life, Steve's got the reach to back up his principles. He says, "Son, I'll ask you to apologize to Corporal Jones here." And this idiot was a buck private, and I suppose didn't realize Steve's got two bars on account of he wasn't wearing his cover. So this kid says, "I'll slap my own mother before apologizing to a nigger." And then we all stood up, Jones included, but I got Dugan to hold him back on account of if this does turn into a brawl, then the Negro's gonna get blamed for it, isn't he? But Steve just reached down, put on his cover, and then stood up on the moving train and said, "I don't like to repeat myself." There's advantages to rank. Well, Jones got his apology, and the other GIs found another car, and the ride back was not too bad. December 30th. Waiting for weather to get worse for our transport. Yes, that is correct. Not to clear, but to get worse so as to conceal our infill. We are to parachute in well behind the winter line in order to pursue our objective in Austria. I have done enough seaborne landings now to know I do not prefer them, which is not to say I wanted to switch to airborne, but it is out of my hands now. I guess they thought 2 days of jump training was enough. Anyhow, we have K-rations enough to last for at least a week, but Command does not believe it will take that long, assuming the 45th does their job on the return side. We only have to meet our objective and then link up with the Thunderbirds. It sounds so simple when put to paper. I don't think I've slept since Asano. I will do my part. December 31st. Drop successful despite awful weather, which cleared this morning. Landing clear. It is cold as fuck, but marching warms a man up a bit. It was cold in England, but nothing of this. Also, no snow in England, and plenty of it here. Just hours left in 1943. Surely it is the worst year the world has ever seen, at least, and I suppose this goes without saying, the worst I have ever seen. Now that our great crusade has begun, I feel harder, somehow, than I did before. In the last month, it feels like I have just been limping and gasping along. But now that we are doing something, it feels like I may be able to bear it all a little while longer. Thank you.